Creepercast, episode 112. Hey, we got a guest. His name is D.A. Roberts.
Hi, this is Rhiannon Frater. I'm the author of the As the World Dies trilogy, and you are listening to the Creepercast.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Creepercast. I'm Jason, and with me always is Jeff and Mike. Mike is kind of like the Honey Boo Boo of the horror podcasting world.
Oh, I hate you. I really do.
I told you that would come back to haunt you. All right. Want to let you guys know we do have a very special guest. He's an author. His name is D.A. Roberts. And rather than me trying to give a background, I'm going to throw it off to Mike to tell us a little bit about D.A. and let him introduce him.
Nothing like putting me on the spot, you jerk. yes, D.A. Roberts is the author of the Ragnarok Rising series. This is actually going to be part of my book review, but I'll just throw it out there now. Mr. Roberts sent us here at the Creepercast a copy of his first book, Ragnarok Rising, The Awakening, a zombie survival horror book. I will admit I was a little reluctant to read it at first because, as I've said before, I feel there's a glut on the market and it's been done. But I will say I was very pleasantly surprised. I really enjoyed the book. And I was fortunate enough to speak with Mr. Roberts on another podcast about a month and a half ago or so. And I got to actually speak with him. And he's a very nice gentleman. He's out of the great state of Missouri, which is not too far from here. And he will be joining us talking about zombie survival. He will be talking when we talk about Zombieland, the rules for surviving, and hopefully we'll get a good discussion about zombies and survival horror and maybe what scares him. So welcome to the show, D.A.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Mike.
So I want to real quick jump in. Zombie survival, I mean, that's a big thing right now going on. Even the Department of Defense or Homeland Security actually did some zombie survival training this past month.
Well, yeah, just a couple of days ago, they were talking about zombies on the floor of Parliament in Canada.
Yeah, that's true. They were.
I thought that was an everyday thing.
No, that's just the hockey fans.
So this whole, zombie survival, I mean, that's what I love looking at your website is, you know, you've got the zombie gear, you got the zombie survival. It's not just about your book and everything. So, you know, with all of that, I mean, what is it that draws people to zombie survival? Not just, you know, nobody ever thinks about vampire survival.
Exactly.
I do. I think about it every damn day.
Yeah, Mike has crosses all over in his house. There's garlic hanging from every doorknob.
I just don't invite people in.
enter freely and of your own accord.
If you can.
If you can cross the threshold, you're fine. I think zombies really play on a primitive part of everybody's brain. It's that fear of death and what lies beyond. Every religion has their own afterlife theory, their own afterlife and end of the world story, but nobody really knows for sure. And it's that thought of what lies beyond and the thought of returning as a flesh-eating zombie really terrifies a lot of people on a pretty primitive level. And I think the zombie genre really plays into that. You know, thank you, George Romero.
Yes. And really, he is the one that changed everything, because before that, you say the word zombie and all anybody ever thought about was voodoo.
Yeah. Well, they made a few zombie-type movies back in the old black and white movie days. The old movie, I think, had Bela Lugosi in it, White Zombie.
Yeah.
They made some early attempts at horror zombie movies, and even saw one late night on the Elvira show. Cannot remember the name of it, but they were really bad. it wasn't until George Romero brought them screaming into the modern age that it really started playing on that primitive part of your brainstem.
Right. So, and then, of course, you know, it's not just the fact that, you know, zombies, it's the survival aspect, which I think, as we saw with a lot of the natural disasters that happened this past year, is that if you're prepared for a zombie apocalypse, you can pretty much survive anything that nature can throw at you.
Just about, yeah. Zombie survival really has turned into something of a metaphor. Like you were saying, if you're prepared for a zombie apocalypse, you'd be stunned what you're prepared for. I think that is something that is really prevalent in everybody's mind with a tough economy and not knowing how things are going to go in the future. How are we going to survive? And it really kind of plays into that whole aspect of everybody's lives. It's something people can relate to. You know, far more than you can relate to sparkly vampires.
We don't discuss those on this show.
Okay.
Well, you know, if we're going to discuss those, then I'm going to continually try to beat into people's heads that dead people are dead. Loving them will not make them alive again.
Right there with you.
So you're saying whether they have fangs or whether they're the walking dead, you can't bring them back to life with love.
That's true. Yeah. Yes. I will say that for both species.
I like my vampires deadly. I don't like cuddly werewolves, and I like my undead dead. I don't think that there's something that you should be wanting to date.
Well, I'm sure there's, you know, there's a whole class of necrophiliacs out there just waiting for the zombie apocalypse to happen.
And that'll be the zombies will be running from them.
Yeah,
they watch Dead Girl over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, that poor girl. Anyway, no.
Well, what about the guy that got his dick bit off by her?
Well, it was his dumb mistake for at least not breaking the teeth out first. Come on.
That's like a prison thing going on there. Break the teeth out.
So wrong, I know.
Oh, yeah. On several levels.
I think with that, let's head into zombie land because I can't.
Well, we'll look at zombie land from we'll look at zombie land basically from the rule aspect, because we've talked about zombie land before way back at the beginning of the Creeper cast, and we would love for you to go back and visit and listen to how dumb we were then.
It doesn't make us much better now.
But in the meantime, or young and dumb, or green, or whatever color you want to call it. Purple with yellow stripes. Anyway, rule number one.
I feel I missed out on that because I wasn't a part of the cast then, but I just want to throw this. I watched this movie again for the first time in a while, and I'm glad I did because I caught some other things that I hadn't seen. And I think this movie, you know, holds up as a zombie comedy, but more importantly to our discussion tonight, the rules hold up, I think.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
even though a lot of them are tongue in cheek, you still, you know, when you look back at it and go, you know, that makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense in a lot of things, though, not just zombies.
Right.
Some of these rules could be any type of rules that you should follow. Like rule number two, beware of bathrooms. I think everybody should be aware of bathrooms, whether there's possibility of zombies or not.
Didn't we learn that last week with when we talked about Rage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and honestly, anytime I go into a public restroom, I'm fearing for my life. So,
yeah, exactly. We've all seen enough horror movies to know what happens in bathrooms.
Hell, I'm not even talking about horror movies.
I was going to say, haven't you ever stopped off by accident or had to run in in the middle of the night and went, "Oh, I need to leave,"
because a politician is trying to proposition you underneath the wall?
Yes, that could be it.
Yes. Or that you walk into a gas station bathroom and you hear your boots go on the floor.
Yes.
Oh, now there's an image I'm never getting rid of.
Stay out of truck stops, I tell you.
Midnight truck stops, or it's actually truck stops any time of the day. You know, it's one of them where you're looking, going, you know, there's a set of woods over there. I think it's more sanitary.
Yeah, after my time as a corrections officer, I just look at my kids and say, "Touch nothing."
I think I just got hepatitis 9.
Hep is Z29.
Gonna sip a herpalades.
All right. All right. So Zombieland, you know, for those of you that somehow haven't seen it, it's about a shy student trying to reach his family in Ohio, along with a gun-toting guy trying to find the last Twinkie, and a pair of sisters trying to get to an amusement park where they all join forces to travel across a zombie-filled America, which I swear that they went the wrong direction if they were all trying to head east. But here's the trailer to kind of get an idea.
Planet Earth, home to over 6 billion people. Today, our very existence is threatened by epidemics, climate change, and dwindling resources. But those are the least of our problems. Welcome to Zombieland.
My mother always told me, someday you'll be good at something. I mean, I don't think she could have guessed that something would be zombie killing.
What do you think? Zombie kill of the week?
Close. But no cigar. Zombie Kill of the Week went to Miss Cynthia Knickerbocker.
Gotta enjoy the little things.
These fellas really let themselves go.
Zombieland.
You guys want some Purell?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, Zombieland had just an awesome cast. I mean, Jesse Eisenberg, Woody Harrelson, Emma Stone, Abigail Breslin, and Bill Murray.
Can't forget Bill Murray.
Yeah.
As himself, which is even better.
Even though he was more of a third dairy character, yeah.
Right.
I mean, tertiary?
There you go. There you go. We are talking about Bill, so yeah.
Yeah.
That would be the right word.
So yeah, and then
in the meantime, we also do have, like you mentioned last week on the news, and finally got posted to the website. I believe I just finally posted it, but all the news on the news on the new Zombieland series that will hopefully be attacking Amazon, and three cast members already in. I mean, the only one we're worried about now is Tallahassee and who's going to play Bill Murray.
So how are we going to cast Bill Murray?
He can be a zombie.
That's true. You zombie him up enough, you could put just about anybody in there.
Saw Eddie Van Halen the other day. How is he? He's dead.
And he's honestly, I can't hear the song For Whom the Bell Tolls anymore without thinking about this movie.
I know. Now, the thing about this movie, what I love really about it all is right from the get-go, this has to have probably one of the best openings to a zombie film ever.
Yeah, the bit with the zombie stripper chasing that
With the
still got money in his hand.
Well, and then the guy behind him's running out with a drink still in his hand.
Yeah. Well, you can't, you know, you paid $7 for a mixed drink. You're not going to leave it.
I'm getting my money's worth, damn it.
But yeah, right from the get-go, you know, it's like, this is not the United States. This is the United States of Zombieland. I loved it. I mean, it's just right from the get-go, action-packed. That's where it's different than a lot of other zombie movies. Other zombie movies, it's a slow build-up as the zombie horde grows kind of deal. This one, it's like, okay, we're going to drop you right in the center of everything, and then we'll give you a little bit of backstory as we go along.
And I think that was great about this movie. Like you said, most of them, you know, you have, with the exception of maybe Romero's Land of the Dead or, you know, some of his couple of the earlier ones where it's after the apocalypse has happened. Usually it's, you know, it starts here, it builds up, and, you know, I like the fact that, you know, we got right.
I think we lost Hello? Mike.
Uh-oh. I think we did. Mid sentence.
No, it was kind of cool.
Okay. Oh,
there you go.
I hit my keyboard. My bad. See, I'm just gesturing very wildly with my hands.
He was attacked. Okay. It was.
It was Bill Murray. He climbed up my balcony. And, anyways, I love the fact that they dropped us right into the action of it, and the rules are smart. Although the two girls somehow survived as long as they did, but they did the dumbest thing I've ever seen in a horror movie. You know, going to the Pacific Playland or whatever the hell it was called.
Enlighten everything up.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, that's not going to attract everything with an appetite for 100 miles.
Yeah, and not even The Walking Dead. You know, I mean, if there were, you know, those roaming bands of nomads that, you know, you like you read about in Stephen King's The Stand, you know, that enslave women. Yeah, every bad thing within 100 miles is coming to get you.
Yeah. That's the kind of attention you don't want.
So,
and ultimately, that's why this movie basically, you know, officially rounds out what we have done as Zombies 101, where we were talking about zombie films for the last year and basically putting them into categories. This would be the post-apocalyptic category because this film really dropped us right in the middle of the apocalypse. And it's living in Zombieland is really what we're talking about here. Is what would we, you know, how would we survive in this Zombieland world using some of the same rules that Zombieland has taught us?
So let's talk about the rules. Like, what was it? Rule number two, the double tap?
Well, yeah. I've got 33 of the rules in front of me.
I have 32.
Now, my question is, because I actually heard someone say or read somewhere that the double tap was a waste of ammunition.
I totally agree.
If you shoot him in the head first.
Yeah. Don't waste your ammo shooting in the chest. You know, shoot him in the head, they stay dead.
Right.
And after the apocalypse, ammo is going to be worth its weight in gold, so I'm not going to be wasting two shots. I'm going to make my first one count.
That brings us to a really good discussion that I think is pretty much going to be me and DA. Jeff will maybe jump in a little bit, but...
Make stupid comments every now and then, yes.
Yeah.
I'll do my best.
One of the big arguments always when it comes to post-apocalyptic zombie survival is your weapons. What kind of weapons, and especially what kind of gun... You know, I think when in anything, whether you're talking about carrying a concealed weapon now or you're fighting off a zombie horde or you're just trying to survive, what weapon you choose. I mean, I think everybody has their preferences and people will argue for hours on this.
Well, I've got kind of a different take on it. Of course, you know, under ideal circumstances with unlimited ammo, ammo not being a factor, I'd probably take, you know, something on the AR platform, probably an M4. The AK-47 is a great rifle, but if you're going to be on the move and you're going to have to scrounge for your ammo, I would modify a Ruger 10/22. One, the 22 ammo is going to be abundant. Nobody's going to be scavenging for 22 ammo. And two, the 22, especially a 22 hollow point, has enough power behind it to puncture the skull but not come back out. It's going to go in and make scrambled eggs out of whatever's inside there. And it's going to be a fine weapon for a zombie. Not to mention the Ruger 10/22 has so many available platforms. You go to cheaperthandirt.com and you can do anything in the world to a Ruger 10/22.
Yeah, actually, I'm there right now and I completely agree with you that as far as zombie survival, see, now most people when you carry, you want, you know, depending on the size, and I always tell people, you know, you get the biggest size that you can handle. So, you know, I like a 40 caliber because I like that transfer of energy of that, that you get from a 40 and a 45.
And I like the 45. Under ideal circumstances, I'd have a 45.
And you know, going back to Zombieland and rule number 9, guns are for hunting, not for zombie killing. It's a simple idea here. Like DA has already mentioned, is that guns need bullets. When you're running, who has time to stop for bullets? Keeping a shotgun with a buckshot on hand is important, but only when you're pinned in and need a quick getaway.
Well,
it's not a proper means by killing zombies, as they run out of ammo and need reloading. Remember, a cricket bat or a toilet lid do not need reloading. I'm a blade fan myself, and the last time I used a sword, I didn't have to reload it.
See, I go with different levels.
You don't have to reload a sword, but you do have to get close, which in most cases is closer than I want to be.
Right. I exactly agree. The way that I look at it is... I want 4 different weapons on me at all times. I want a long, a quick reaction, a backup, and a melee weapon. So my long weapon, I agree with the 22. I say go with 22 everything because you can have the same rounds used in your rifle and your pistol. So go with something. I like the GSG AK-47 22 semi-auto.
Yeah.
That to me is a great one. That would be, you know, and they're not that expensive to get right now.
That's why I'd go with the 10/22. You can pick them up at Academy for less than $200.
Yeah. So something like that would be great. A 22, you want something with a nice big clip in it is what you want.
Oh, definitely.
All right. But then also with that, you can get a 22 pistol right along with that. And you can, I don't care. Go pick your brand, pick whatever. 22 pistols are nice because they're cheap comparatively. And they're small and lightweight. And you can carry a lot.
Yeah. You can carry 10,000 rounds and really not overburden yourself.
Exactly.
22 rounds are small.
And you can pick them up in boxes of 1,000 for almost nothing right now to stock up. So that's something to really think about. The other thing to think about with the 22 is that for most other rifles, I'm sticking with rifles right now, is that you have to basically go to a sporting store that carries them. Walmart would carry them, but someplace that has a sporting department. 22s you can pick up almost anywhere. They sell them at, I've seen them sold at gas stations. I've seen them sold at hardware stores. I mean, they're so ubiquitous.
Yeah. Another good thing about the 22 is any weapon you use, any weapon you're going to have, you need to be proficient with. And you can go out and target practice all day for $20 with a 22.
And you're not going to be getting a shooter's shoulder either.
Exactly.
So that's something nice. And then the same thing with the 22 is that it's not going to be, if anybody that goes to the shooting range and knows that you get very fatigued with a pistol when you're popping off a lot of rounds. I don't get fatigued with a 22. Now for hunting or for something else, I also suggest if you can get one is get an air rifle. And I'm not talking like the Red Ryder BB gun. The Red Rover, a good air rifle. Those things have pretty much the same velocity as a 22. They will go through the skull and they're quiet, so they won't draw attention, and you can actually hunt with them.
Well, a good book to have on hand would be the SAS Survival Guide, and it teaches all kinds of snares. Fantastic book for if you're just wanting to learn how to trap small game.
And snares is a great thing to know how to do because you let the you let the snare do the hunting for you, so you can set up 10-20 snares. Raise your chances of getting whatever you're going after rather than trying to walk around and waste time hunting and energy.
I grew up in the backwoods of Missouri primarily, and I could feed myself and my family indefinitely if we had to bug out off just what I could snare and running a jug line off for fish.
So that would be the 22 would be for my third level of defense and my first level of defense. First level being the long shot. I'm trying to take them out as far away as I can from before they get to me. Third level of defense is my pistol. That is, you know, it's always said, you know, what's the best gun to get or what's the best gun to have? It's the one you have on hand. So
exactly.
Having a pistol on hand is always with you. You never have to worry about it. It's right there in your holster. I also like carrying for a reactionary weapon, a pump action 12 gauge shotgun. With buckshot in it.
Have you seen the Kel-Tec shotgun?
Oh, yes. That thing is so beautiful.
15 rounds, baby.
And the reason, the main reason I like pump action is because I notice that when I have a semi-auto shotgun in my hand, I tend to pull the trigger too fast and waste rounds. So I can take, you know, one quick reactionary shot. It's got, if you saw it off, so it's, you know, got a short barrel to it. It's got a good spread to it, and you don't have to really aim. It's not meant to be an aiming weapon. It's meant to be a reactionary shoot from the hip weapon.
Yeah, they used to refer to them in the 1800s as a street howitzer.
And then finally, the melee weapon. Jeff can use a sword if he wants. You know, I prefer a hatchet because
I want a hammer.
Hammer's a good one. The reason I like a hatchet. Reason I like a hatchet is because it's got the weight to crack the skull, it's got the blade to cut in, and you can chop wood with it. It's got dual purposes.
You chop wood with a sword.
Yeah, if you want to ruin the edge.
So that's my view on weaponry. And then, of course, anything else. You know, I like rule number 6, the skillet. You know, basically anything you have in hand to be able to defend yourself, use it. So if you can't get to your firearm, if you can't get to something to help you, anything you have, I don't care what it is. If it's a beer bottle, use it.
Just about anything can be used as an improvised weapon in an emergency.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that.
You can put somebody down with a Los Angeles phone book.
And probably an Albuquerque one too.
You know, I was actually listening. I'm going to talk about real quick. I was listening to an episode of The Evolution of the Apocalypse, our friends over there. And they were talking about armor, like how, like putting armor around yourself and stuff that they were talking about and what to do and stuff. And one thing that I was thinking when they were talking is, you know, the only main parts that you really need armor on are your arms and your legs, i.e. your forearms and your shins, because those are the two main parts that people use to defend themselves when somebody's coming after you.
Well, one thing I learned from a buddy of mine in the SCA is never underestimate the value of duct tape.
Yes.
Yes. That is actually, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most important things to put in your bug out bag.
Oh, absolutely. You've got to have a big roll of duct tape, or as I refer to it, as redneck repair tape.
That stuff can be used for medicine, repairs, and in this case, you know what? Take a magazine, any magazine. It doesn't matter what it is. You could wrap that thing around your forearm and tape it on with duct tape, and you have yourself – a zombie can't bite through,
That. Unless your zombie's a lion, it's not coming through that.
No. And in fact, I know I have friends, and I'm sure you can relate to this, DA. I have friends that work in the prison system, and people that are afraid of getting shanked in there will actually put magazines and tape them around themselves to use as an improvised way of stab protection.
I've also seen them take, and this is from my experience as a CO, they've take layer upon layer of newspaper, get it wet, lay it together, and let it harden. Oh man, you can't put anything through that. You get enough layers of newspaper, getting it wet, and maybe spreading some toothpaste on it. Then next layer down, get it wet, spread some toothpaste. Next layer down, do that 8 or 10 times. It becomes so rigid, you're not going to put a shank through it.
I was watching an episode of what's the one with the burn spy? Burn Notice.
Yeah.
And Fiona was in the prison, and she had to take on a group of women. And in order to make herself a club, she actually took newspaper and soaked it in salt water and then rolled it up and let it dry like that. And evidently it was hard enough to beat them with.
Well, you got to remember, newspaper is basically pulped wood. And it, you know, given enough force behind it, and then rolling it up tight enough, it's still wood.
True.
All right. With that, also, I'm actually going to jump off and say, don't forget to get a hold of us by giving us a call at 503-454-6941, or emailing us at feedback@creepercast.com to give us your tips on zombie survival. And coming up later, we will have the drawing for the iTunes sweepstakes. All right, so I think that covers kind of what, you know, we can go into for you know, firearms and for some defensive weapons. Any other things that you like as far as defensive weapons?
I would actually jump in and say that I'm more the Daryl type, so I'm gonna be like, you know, to pick my three main weapons. Yes, there would definitely be a gun involved. But my three main weapons would be, I would be part Michonne and part Daryl. I'd have to have the crossbow. I'd have to have the katana. And then I'd want a longbow too, for long distance, you know, for longer distance shooting.
I'd definitely rather have a longbow than a crossbow.
Yeah, the problem that I have with the crossbow, which they don't really show in The Walking Dead, is they actually take a long time to reload.
Yeah, it's fairly slow to reload weapon. That's why I prefer the longbow. If you give me a longbow as a hunting / distance weapon, I could do pretty well. But I want a big, heavy-duty bludgeoning hammer.
Yeah. I would agree with that, especially if you go all Thor on some dead person. Yeah.
Or, you know, even
it's
something
never going to get stuck in a wound.
even something as simple as an ice pick.
Oh yeah.
Or not an ice, not like, or not, I don't mean an ice pick, like a hand ice pick, but even something as simple as like a pickaxe, an ice chipper. You know, basically they're a big metal pole with a blade on the end. It's a mace.
When I was in the Army during bayonet training, they had these dummies that we would stab with the bayonets that was supposed to simulate human tissue. And you've got to work pretty hard to get a dang blade out of something. And personally, I'd just rather, you know, hit it with something that's not going to stick.
Yeah. And that's where I think I like the hatchet, because the hatchet doesn't go in that deep where it's not a blade that you're sticking in and have to pull out. It's something that you crack in there and then you hurry up and you got the leverage to pull it out.
Well, when I was a firefighter, I came up with this idea for some stories that I'm writing that basically have to do with like a volunteer firefighter group that is actually zombie killers, because I always, I love the tools that are used in firefighting, especially the axe and the halberd and all that are great tools that I think would work great in a zombie fighting situation.
Speaking of firefighters, my nephew is a firefighter up in Lebanon, Missouri, and him and I got to talking one night, and I was trying to design a new weapon for Wiley to use in Book 3, which I'm working on now, and we came up with the idea of using a firefighter hoolie stick.
Yeah.
Is that hook stick?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Only he's going to weld a hammerhead on one end of it and keep the pry bar end on the other. Basically, it's a big-ass universal tool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about, especially since as firemen know, is that when you run out, you have your group that are the pump ops and all that, and then you have the people that are actually supposed to go up there and work towards ventilation and everything. And actually the first tools you grab is the axe and then your pry tool or something along that route. And then you got somebody who's grabbing the halberd, and for some reason I'm drawing a blank on actually what I consider to be the most important tool of the bunch. But the Halligan, there we go, is, you grab that sucker and you've pretty much got every possible close weapon you need in a zombie situation.
Now, this is kind of off, and I'm sure it probably won't work on an actual zombie, but when I was with the police department and we had to serve warrants, the first person, normally me, because I was the runt of the group, I was the youngin', the first person in actually carried a CO2 fire extinguisher, because if somebody rushed us, rather than littering them with bullets, or if it's an animal, you blast them in the face with the cold CO2.
Huh. You see, that'd be pretty effective.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how that would work with a zombie, but, it seems like it'd be a good...
At least it'd be a distraction.
Yeah.
For a second, yeah, you would think it'd be... Well, we are talking about dead people that don't necessarily see or anything, so... Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It might last it'd be worth trying once. You'd only get one shot, so.
Well, if all else fails, you could always hit it with the fire extinguisher.
Yeah.
It's kind of a big weapon to be doing it with, but it works.
Just make sure you have a Halligan with you and you can do anything you want.
Got a point.
Literally. Da-dun-tsh.
Oh, really?
You want me to pull out the sound effects?
That didn't deserve a rim shot. Come on.
All right. Some of the other ones that they have, at least on mine, and I got my the rules that I picked from zombielandrules.com, which is unofficial. So I'm sure it's a little bit different than what you have, Jeff. Of course, number one, they say cardio. I think that's, that's definitely going to be important.
It's a number one in a lot of situations.
Well, not necessarily. You could always be the mercenary type like Shane from The Walking Dead and just take out the nearest guy's leg.
Yeah. Which is interesting, because that one actually falls, Otis, under one of the rules, though. The way they explain it in the film is a little different, but they do talk about, keeping the dum-dums close at hand. Yeah. And, of course, the way they put it is, at least the way they put it for, Zombieland rules, is that at least they know when it's time to run, they will just run and won't think that zombies are Amway calling. Whereas I would say it's more like the Shane situation is that the dumb ones might be like, hey, what's going on? When, while they're getting eaten, you get out of there.
You don't have to be the fastest. You just have to shoot the guy next to you.
Yeah. Don't have to be the fastest. You just have to be faster than the guy with the gun.
Yes. All right. Beware of bathrooms. That's one that I actually never thought of until this film. Is that if you think
like
about
said,
when
at
you're
the
most
of the show, it seems like that should be all the time.
Yeah, the time when you're the most vulnerable in any situation is either when you're taking a shower or when you're on the shitter.
That's why you keep a waterproof Kydex holster in your shower.
I like Kydex.
Kydex makes great stuff.
I know. I love their stuff. As me and you are like geeking out and Mike and Jeff are going, what?
What?
Well, no, not well, I wasn't geeking out exactly. I was thinking of rule number whatever it was that said Ziploc. And then, you know,
yeah,
Ziploc.
And
you,
actually,
Ziploc your...
I have a clip for that that I found. So let me cue this up. Come on. You can play. Oh, of course, there's a advertisement at the beginning. So we have to go through 15 seconds of advertisement. But with that, the Ziploc bag, I guess, was a part that was cut from the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the special features. And you can find it on YouTube. And here it is. Right now. Right here.
Rule number two, Ziploc bags. You got enough problems. Moisture shouldn't be one of them.
So basically what it is it's a clip of a guy trying to light a lantern with a match, and the match won't light. Ziploc bags, you know, anything for waterproof, because we're so used to being in climate-controlled environments that when the apocalypse hits, you won't have a climate-controlled environment. So you have to control the climate in any way you can, just like camping. Ziploc bags help. Anything that you can put in one of them vacuum seal bags, that will help. Moisture packets. Especially, here's the thing, when it comes to ammunition, keeping that dry and in as much of a climate-controlled environment as you can is going to mean life or death.
Absolutely. Keeping your weapon dry is going to be important, too.
Yeah, ask anybody that fought in Vietnam.
Yeah.
One of the tricks that my uncle told me when he was in Vietnam and they had the god-awful bad M16s at the time.
The Jammin' Jenny?
Yes. Was that they used to actually put condoms on the ends of their guns.
I was just going to say that. A buddy of mine said they did the same thing in Desert Storm to keep the sand out of the barrels.
So, and that's one where, you know, I would have to say the AK-47 seriously has the M16 beat out.
Well, the Russians certainly designed a weapon designed for any and all environments. I'm from the worst parts of Siberia to the deserts of northern Africa, that weapon's going to fire.
Yeah. You could take a handful of sand, throw it right in it, and the thing will still fire.
You could drop it in a mud puddle, pick it up, and it'd still fire.
So that's where, you know, an AK-47 edges out something like the AR-15 or the M16. However, I think in modern times they've gotten so much better that I've never had my AR jam on me.
Well, the AR platform has improved a lot over the last 40 years. They're pretty reliable now, but they still can be pretty finicky when not kept clean.
So learn how to clean your weapon, keep things in plastic bags, especially stuff when it comes to matches, anything like that. I'm a fan of them magnesium fire sticks.
Oh, those are fantastic.
Because those things, you can go swimming with them and they will still light a fire for you.
And it doesn't matter if the wood's wet or not. Magnesium burns at about 7,600 degrees Fahrenheit. It's going to catch.
Right. And the spark that it puts out is at 1,500 degrees, which is actually more powerful than a lighter. A lighter is 550 degrees. I'm talking like a Bic lighter.
Yeah.
The flame on that is 550 degrees. The spark that those things put out is 1,500 degrees. Then you add the magnesium. Those things are great for lighting just about anything. All right.
I totally agree.
I'm totally in agreement with you, and that's why you should also travel in groups, because the best way to increase your odds of survival is to be amongst a buffet.
Well, not necessarily amongst a buffet. Your best chance of survival is going to be with a diverse group of skill sets.
Right.
You know.
Yes.
You've got guys who know things about firearms, and you're going to need someone that knows something about first aid, water purification. These are skills that not generally found in one person. Now there are people that know all these people that have been there, done that, have a closet full of t-shirts, but it's always good to have a broad skill base to draw from.
Even something as simple as I know a lot of what you just talked about. I know a lot about firearms. I know a lot about wilderness survival. I know a lot about that. But if my car breaks down, I'm screwed because my knowledge of automotives is nil.
Well, the beauty of that is during the zombie apocalypse, if your car breaks down, just take another.
that's true, but at the same time,
transfer your gear to the nearest SUV and bug on out.
That's true, but I think having, like you said, in your group, somebody that even knows a little bit of something about automotives. Yeah,
just basic auto mechanics.
Yeah, at least have a Dale in the group.
Yes.
Someone that can at least keep a generator running if necessary. Yeah.
Right.
And all I want to say is, after everything the DA just said, is see, Mom, D&D does teach people stuff.
There you go. Diversify your party.
Yes.
And then you also need to have, the person there that is just so that you can get away.
Yeah. Cannon fodder.
Yes.
The one you can kneecap, yeah.
Yeah.
I would even suggest find the most annoying person. Gag him and handcuff him and carry him around so that,
Just for that circumstance,
you can be like, okay, time to drop him. I don't know where to go from there.
Nobody has a response to that.
Like on Firefly, drop a crybaby.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cry, baby, cry.
So, I got to jump a little bit into The Walking Dead with the baby being born and stuff. Why do I see later on them trying to hide from a horde of zombies and the baby not stopping crying?
That could get pretty bad pretty fast.
Well, it's a stereotypical situation, too. So it's almost like a sure thing.
Well, I think about my son today who's a year and a half, as we were at a banquet, and the person's up there talking and we're trying to keep him quiet, and he's just going off, and it's like, man, this would suck if we were trying to survive.
Well, they handled that problem pretty solidly in the comics, which the series has diverged quite a bit from the comics, but in the comic book, as they were leaving the prison, the governor's people shot Lori and the baby in the back, killed them both. Which that was in the comics.
That's not going to happen. Yeah.
So yeah, that's because she's already dead.
But yeah, it is a classic situation. It actually reminds me of when I was a kid and I was watching. I don't know if I'm probably because I'm so old, I'm probably the only one who remembers this, but the last episode of MASH,
yeah,
which was the one about when Hawkeye was going through that. The woman supposedly strangled a chicken on the bus when they were supposed to be really quiet, but then you find out later she had smothered her baby.
Yeah. Yes, I remember that.
It continually makes me think about that whenever you bring this up. Is somebody going to be willing to go that far with it, or are people going to die over it? Or, it's a definite setup, stereotypical circumstance that we'll undoubtedly see probably this season.
Avoid strip clubs. I think with that, it means don't go to places where people congregate.
Yeah, like malls.
Right.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that they said that basically if you look under the rule for staying out of bathrooms or beware of bathrooms, that they say the only place worse than a bathroom is a theater. Because even though there's lots of places to run, there's nowhere to escape to.
Well, you basically only have two exits out of a theater.
Yeah.
And there's no way to get up high either.
Unless they get a balcony. Oh,
there's a stripper pole you can climb. the stripper pole
is going to be coated with so many years of sweat and tears of disappointment.
I wasn't thinking sweat and tears, but okay, we'll go with that.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
Yeah, let's stick to that. Let's keep it, PGR-13.
All right. Why don't we finish this conversation after Mike gives his book review? What do you say?
Sounds great.
All righty then. Do I get music this week or am I just jumping in?
There's your little swoosh, and here's your music.
All right, welcome to this week's Captain Creeper's Book Corner. As stated at the beginning of the show, this week's book is Ragnarok Rising, The Awakening, the first book by author D.A. Roberts. It rounds out at about 418 pages, and it came out June 30th, 2012. Your basic plot is initial reports of rioting and chaos begin to appear in the news, slowly spreading east from California. As the usual quote-unquote riots come closer and closer, however, the first hints of their true nature begin to emerge. Internet videos show rioters eating those they overtake. When the disturbance finally reaches Springfield, Missouri, all law enforcement officers are called to field duty. Officer Wiley Grant finds himself manning a remote checkpoint. There, the true nature of the rioters becomes terrifyingly clear, and only Wiley and Corporal Chrissy Wilder survive the revelation. Their new goal becomes to survive. So, my likes and dislikes. As I said, this is the first book by Roberts in his Ragnarok Rising series, and we're very fortunate, or at least I'm very fortunate, that he sent us the book, because I doubt I would have come across it on my own. Or if I did, I might have passed it by because, again, as I've mentioned, I feel there's a glut on the market and I'm honestly getting a little tired of zombies. That being said, I have to say that once again, I was pleasantly surprised to find I actually enjoyed this book. It has the usual stock of characters and starts out the same as a lot of zombie books, where an unknown outbreak starts in other parts of the country and spreads, eventually closing in on our hero's location. But what's nice is there isn't a lot of the denial of zombies not being possible. Our characters quickly realize what the threat is and adapt accordingly. I constantly found myself rooting for the main characters and wishing for the deaths of others. Surprisingly, the characters I wanted dead the most weren't even given that much attention in the book, but I still want them to get their faces eaten off. Now, there is some bad to this book. It tends to get a bit repetitive as Wiley, our protagonist, keeps going back on a rescue and scavenging missions. I felt overwhelmed at times with road names and directions as our group of heroes went looking for other survivors. I'm not from Missouri, and I've only ever driven through it, so a lot of the road descriptions meant nothing to me. But I'm sure that from anyone from that area who reads a book will get a kick out of recognizing the area. And of course, Mr. Roberts gets if he gets the details wrong, they will be the first to criticize it. one of the things that really didn't appeal to me was the focus on all the weapons, because I'm not a gun enthusiast. So the mention of weapon after weapon was a bit distracting since I had no idea what they were talking about. Another thing that I did like was, for the lack of better word, realism in the book. I know. Realism in a zombie novel. Yes, I said it right. Realism. Here's the thing. Any of you who have listened to me on the show or read my reviews will notice that I can only take suspension of disbelief so far, and then I get pissy. Roberts does a great job of not taking things too far. The vehicles, which become our hero's main mode of transportation, and you'll forgive me, DA, that I don't remember what they were called, but the main mode of transportation that they use for search and rescue, they take a hell of a beating, and Roberts doesn't ignore the laws of reality. One vehicle loses its topside gun while crashing through a house, and they abandon another one due to it being unfit to drive anymore. excuse me. Our characters also suffer injuries, and it affects them like it would anyone. There aren't any superheroes or BFGs, and certainly no dead reckoning. Yes, those were obscure pop culture references again. Come on, people. Google was invented for a reason. excuse me. Now, I want to mention this. I went and read some other reviews, and I wanted to address a couple of the issues that didn't even occur to me when I read the book. One reviewer ragged on the book for like three paragraphs, and then In the end, what seemed to be a throwaway sentence mentions the focus, or lack thereof, of Norse mythology. And yes, Wiley's character professes to worship the Norse gods as opposed to Christianity, and yes, there is very little explanation about it or for it, but I have to say, so what? I would think that today we have more tolerance, we would have more tolerance and not focus on someone's religious beliefs. And yes, I hope that in the next book we might get a more background or explanation, but I don't feel it's really the point or the focus of the book. And the other issue I saw repeatedly was people ragging on the fact that the character of Wilder seems to fall for Wiley in a relatively short period of time, and they feel her character is shallow or something for it. And one person mentions that within 24 hours of meeting, they're sleeping alone together in a room and in each other's arms. Now, I've never been enlisted in the military, as you all are well aware of, let alone...
Really?
And let alone been in any sort of combat situation, unless you count my marriage. But it seems to me that this might actually be a normal reaction in the face of what they're dealing with. I honestly don't know, and I'll leave it to the experts, but I never once questioned it while I was reading it. And so overall, this was a pretty good book, and I really liked, and I forgot to put this in my typed up notes, but DA has, I believe it's 5 levels of zombies where we're used to like maybe 2 or 3, and you really need to read the book to experience that fully, and I think you will enjoy it as much as I did. And I even liked the fact that it didn't resolve anything at the end, as you often find in writers with their series. But he left you with a cliffhanger, which means I have to wait for the next book. Bastard. Anyway, I can't read the next. Wait to read the next books. Very well done. Score of 4 out of 5 stabs. It's available currently in paperback and ebook, and that is this week's Captain Creeper's Book Corner.
Mike, I got to tell you, you're pretty ballsy.
Yeah, I was just thinking. I was like, wow, I thought I heard a Glock clock, you know, a click back there. Yeah, there was one point where one of those noises I kept hearing in the background, I was pretty sure was a loading of a weapon. But
hey, what's that red dot on my chest? It seems to be coming from outside.
Actually, no, I'm pretty pleased with the review. Some of the things he pointed out are things that I fixed in book 2. Yeah, I did kind of overdo it with the street names. Really didn't intend to, but I expected some of that to come out in the editing of book 1, but really didn't. And I learned book 1 was really a learning curve for me. It was my first major publication, and being with a small publisher, the bulk of the editing and the rewrites were completely on my shoulders. So I left some things in there that I probably should have edited out. I didn't waste my time with that in the second book. I didn't concentrate so much on the firearms. There is discussion of firearms in the second book, enough to whet the appetite of even your most prolific gun lovers. But it doesn't focus on it as much, and rarely does he mention street names. I didn't think
it was terrible. Obviously, it was a little distracting. For me, anyways, and I think it was because instead of using, you know, they went over by the mall. They went down West Street and cut this way, and it was just like I kept trying to picture it in my head. But just like reading subtitles, I don't do directions very well.
He doesn't read subtitles.
Yes, we know this. So
I was hoping that, in some of the Jack Higgins novels, fantastic writer, he's written scenes with turn-by-turn descriptions of characters in, like, say, the city of Paris. And I've never been to Paris, but I had no trouble following it in my mind. And that's really what I was trying to do, is paint a broad canvas of the city. And I didn't really go back to that in book 2 because I thought maybe I'd already described it well enough. I do mention, you know, turn here, turn there, that kind of thing, but it doesn't really mention streets so much. And I'm hoping at this point I've already painted the image. Now I'm just got the setting.
And it would really be no different. I mean, for me, that would be no different than, say, when, you know, Tolkien painted the picture for The Hobbit. I mean, and then eventually we ended up with a map that totally told us where they were going.
See, if I had a map,
it's no different than that.
You know, there is such a thing, Mike, as Google.
Yeah, you mentioned it. There is such a thing as Google Maps.
Hey, I don't do research either, okay?
As you're telling other people to do it.
I just get paid to read the books, people. I don't have to do the extra work.
And I was gonna actually kind of respond to the whole to the weaponry aspect of it. And you know, you have to forgive me because I forget the name of a lot of the stuff that I've read because I've read so much stuff. But there was like this post-apocalyptic world series that I read that had to something like Badlands or something like that was in the title. It was like this series, and I tried to keep up with it for a while and then just lost touch. But they spent a lot of times describing the weaponry. And so, and then there was books that I remember reading like 10, 20 years ago that were, you know, books about martial artists, you know, I mean, basically you're an action novel that would actually go into descriptions of the weapon. So I'm about halfway through your book, DA. I think I admitted this to you earlier today, but that didn't bother me. That was more of a, you know, I just saw that as like stuff I was kind of used to in that type of a circumstance. But I can see how it can distract for the people who are just looking for rising zombie action.
So with that,
don't make me sound like I'm shallow because I don't like.
Yeah, you're shallow. Like,
it was just simply, you know, I guess for a lot of the books that I read, you know, when there's weaponry described, it's a shotgun, it's a handgun. That's all I need. Because I, you know, I'm not an enthusiast, you know, I couldn't tell the difference between a Glock and a 9mm and a .22 pistol unless you, you know, put it to my forehead.
Mike,
then probably still couldn't
Glock,
tell the difference.
Glock does make 9mm and .22.
Shut up. That's what I'm saying.
Glock is the manufacturer
Shut
of
up.
Calibers.
So,
all right. Well,
I
just wanna...
tried to do. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
One of the things I tried to do was to make the use of weapons real, make it as real as humanly possible. Because I've read a lot of books where they would, you know, say things like work the action on the single shot shotgun or something like that. You know, where they really had no idea what they were talking about. And I'm very familiar with the weapons that they've used. I fired most of them, and I just think that it's one of those things where. Where if you're going to write the weapons, you've got to be accurate because the people that know those weapons and know them well are going to pick it apart.
Right, and that's what I going along like with the street names and the descriptions of where you're going. It didn't mean a whole lot to me, but I'm sure that your readers there in Missouri who are from there, it would be like if I read a book that took place here in Tulsa and they got the streets wrong, I'd be like, oh, that is so wrong. But somebody who's not from Tulsa, it's not going to mean as much to them.
Yeah.
And like I said, I'm not saying it was a bad thing overall. It just was, you know, for me, didn't work as well. Please don't kill me.
No, it all makes perfect sense. I think we were just all kind of picking at the idea that, I mean, everybody can look at that as a different view. I mean, you know, we're all saying that it's great. It's good that you had your view. Other people are going to see it another way, which is pretty much what you said from the beginning. So I don't know why I, you know.
Well, you know, here's the other thing, though, when it comes to the firearms, and I can't speak from reading because I'm illiterate. But at least from, you know, movies, and I'll go with The Walking Dead with this one, is that it drives me nuts when I see stuff like Carl shooting through a fence at a walker, hitting him in the head at 50 yards away with a 38 revolver with a 2-inch barrel.
Yeah, it's an impossible shot for an expert marksman.
Right, exactly.
Not a, you know, 12-year-old kid.
So, you know, that's the stuff that always drives me nuts. So when I'm watching a movie or reading a book, if I, you know, ever do, you know, that's the stuff that would appeal to me is if I just like what DA said, is being that I am an enthusiast. If I hear someone making, you know, a statement like that, I'm going, okay, I can suspend disbelief and say that the dead can rise from the grave. But no, you cannot make that shot.
Not without a tremendous amount of luck.
Yeah. You know, or, you know, we'll even go, you know, I always like when people, when I talk to people that have never fired a weapon before, and they say something like, well, why don't you just shoot them in the leg? And I'm like, well, two reasons. One, I'm not that good of a shot to make sure that I hit them in the leg. And two, I don't want them getting back up.
Yeah, if you shoot someone in the leg, they can still shoot you.
Yeah.
You know, leg doesn't incapacitate.
But, you know, that's the thing with a lot of people that don't understand weapons. They see something like, you know, the old Hawaii 5-0.
Oh, yeah.
Where they would do that. They would shoot someone in the leg from 30 yards away with a, you know, 38 special 2-inch barrel.
Well, when it's a running suspect, you know.
Yeah.
I'll just get him in the thigh.
So, you know, that's the stuff that I think, you know, as far as what you described, him putting in that book would appeal to somebody like me.
Right. And like I said, I'm sure that the people who like you, if you read, you know, and I know that's a really big if, you know, it's not.
But I do read subtitles.
Yeah. I'm not talking about your French porn. Okay. but yeah, I'm sure, like I said, just with the street signs, you know, the gun enthusiasts and the people, that's going to be a big kick for them. So, you know, and like I said, I love the book. I'm so glad that you sent it to us. And I honestly can't wait for the next one.
Well, to be honest, I think you see what it called 4 out of 5 stabs.
Yes.
A 4-star rating to me is gold. I love 4-star ratings. 5-star ratings are fantastic. That means you've got someone that just absolutely loved the book. But a 4-star rating is really the nuts and bolts, because that's a person that's willing to tell you what not only what they liked, but what they didn't. And that's more important to me. I want to know what you didn't like, because that's what I can do better in the next one.
So I got to ask you, DA, what prompted you to write? If this is, you said this is your first, you know, your learning curve.
Kind of a funny story. One night, overnight shift, me and a few fellow officers were sitting around having a cup of coffee. We were in the break room just kind of tossing back coffee and laughing. And one of the guys brought up zombie movies. And I mentioned that I had recently seen the remake of Dawn of the Dead where the zombies were fast. And they're all like, whoa, the zombies are fast. I'm like, yeah. So I had to bring the DVD in and pass it around. But while we were talking about it, one of the guys, a buddy of mine named Chris Sowards, he goes, well, what would we do if it happened here? And we all kind of laughed about it. My buddy Roper goes, you serious? Zombies in Springfield? And he goes, yeah, what would we do? So, you know, at first we laughed about it. But then we actually started discussing it, how we thought our department would deploy and how they'd have to pull up all the reserve officers and even empty the jail. We'd have to have a skeleton crew in the jail. There's 130 of us in the jail. You know, we deal with about 600 inmates at any given time. So there's quite a few officers, 4 shifts of about 30 officers apiece. So that's a pretty big number of officers that can be fielded. So we started discussing how we'd leave a skeleton crew at the jail, and everybody with any weapons training or military training would be put in the field. And from there, it would probably get pretty ugly. Well, after the conversation, next morning I was driving home from work. It's about 7:30 in the morning, and my brain is still just churning all this over. And I'm looking at buildings around town going, wow, could we defend that? And looking at cars going, wow, how would we modify that to try to keep the zombies out of it? And I just couldn't quit thinking about it. A few days later, I started making notes about, you know, outlining the story. And within a month, I had a full-blown story outlined, and I just took off from there.
That's great, because actually that's very close to what happened with me when – I was working night shift overnight, and me and my partner at our department, if you work during the day, you're by yourself. If you're overnight, you have a partner. And anybody that has worked in law enforcement knows that, you know, most of the time you're tooling around in a car bored off your gourd. So we were talking about something like that and talking about the streets and how we would have to defend and stuff like that and how they would move through. So hearing you talk about that where you're at with your buddies, it's amazing how it just so reminiscent of the conversation that we had.
I thought that was a normal reaction that, you know, I walk into a building and go, how could I defend this, or how defensible is this?
How could I survive in it? Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, not just zombies, but, you know, after watching Stephen King's The Mist, you know, what if, you know, every time I walk into a grocery store, I go, how defensible is this building? So are you trying to say that's not a normal thing?
No. Well, no, I doubt he's trying to say that. In fact, I believe that that it is your Uncle Steven, Mr. King himself, that I am quoting here, who actually said that a lot of good stories, a lot of the better stories come from what if.
Yeah.
And that's,
I'd have to agree with that.
That's happened to me a lot, because like I've said with the, you know, I've been working on this idea of volunteer firefighters who, you know, their job is to kill zombies. And it was basically a case is I was out on a run and I was thinking, so if we had to deal with zombies, what would we do? Kind of thing. And, spray, you know, which weapons would be the best and that type of thing. I actually had this running joke that the reason why the firefighters were left in order to protect the community from the zombies is because the cops were the first ones to run into battle and they didn't think before they got there.
Oh,
I can tell you other firefighter jokes about cops if you want.
I've probably heard them already.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And suddenly the red dot is on Jeff's chest.
And that's it's coming all the way from Michigan.
But with that note, actually, I want to be the, you know, since I've already, you know, become the hated one in the group, that means I have to take that step further and apologize to Mike, because I was told this was a non-talk about situation, but it got brought up in and Mike might have already warned you, DA, but it got brought up in the reviews that he was defending against and that type of thing. And I'm with this, you know, I mean, you're the Norse mythology aspect. You have to forgive me. This was like a major thing that I studied the most, you know, mythology is a major thing for me. And, you know, I'm going to defend it from the standpoint of that I don't think that your intention needed to be that your book is about Norse mythology.
No.
It's not about
anybody's religion. It's just what widely happens to be.
Right. And that's and the references back to the Norse mythology that I have read is more of a, I guess I liken it to like when they talk about, you know, when hell is full, the dead will walk the earth. You know, that's mm-hmm. a biblical phrase and, you know, that type of thing. So it's any type of religion has a when the dead walk the earth aspect. So whether or not it's even Wiley's religion doesn't matter in this. But what my interest therefore is not, you know, why didn't you make this more Nordic? My question is why Nordic?
I've always had an interest in Norse mythology, and when I read about Ragnarok, it actually talked about the dead being released from hell, with hell with one L, with Loki leading the army of the dead against the world of men, and that would be one of the beginning signs of Ragnarok, which is the Viking Armageddon. And it just made sense, it just, you know, to go that direction. Not to mention my publisher, Pendrag Publishing, is a pagan publisher. He asked me to add in more pagan elements to kind of fit with his publication model, which most of those references were not in there in the initial draft.
It's interesting that you hooked up with a pagan publisher. You know, I never, honestly, I'm going to say I never knew that, you know, something like that existed.
There's a number of them out there. How I wound up involved with them is I have a friend who lives here in town. I've known him since college. He published through them. He's a Wiccan. And he gave them my name. And they said, well, you know, because I was trying to get my manuscript published, he said, well, have him send it to me. So I sent it to him. And he had Peter Padden, the owner of Pendrag, actually did discuss with me whether or not he was either going to have me put in more pagan elements or if he was willing to change his entire production model just to publish my novel.
That's awesome.
That's pretty awesome. And what I like about that part of the story is, though, is that, like I said, is that the Nordic element is not the most important aspect of the book. The book, to me, is about survival and dealing with the and you know, going on these runs and in order to maintain survival and that type of thing. But the constant references back, even though they were added later, do kind of add to the story from the character aspect of Wiley himself. Is that we know why we kind of have a glimpse into what type of a person he is based on this religious aspect, which I think it's interesting that that's the religion he learns when I don't think there is anybody out there that's, you know, what's claimed to be Nordic, you know, have a Norse mythological belief in anything. They might have some clinging to the gods themselves, but
there's an entire religion on that. It's called Ossetru.
Oh, really?
Google it sometime. It's pretty fascinating. It's actually the official religion of Iceland. It's going back to the old gods, the old ways. It's a lot more people involved in it than you would think.
Wow, see, that's always something that blows my mind when I hear something about something, you know, that is considered mythology to most is actually still a religion, is still a religion of sorts to others. That's, I mean, you know, ancient religions is one thing, but when you take something that's already been termed mythology, then it, you know, it's interesting to find out that there are people out there that still believe in that type of thing. And I actually applaud you on, you know, your ability to later work this in. And it still work out. I mean, because obviously Ragnarok, like you said, and as most people who know anything about Ragnarok, about the Loki leading the army of hell or the army of the dead against the gods. So it is another, you know, another form of, you know, the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, to me, it really didn't set out to write a how-to book. For Norse paganism, I wanted to set a zombie story that showed heroism on an everyday level. Wiley's not Superman. Wiley's not, you know, an unstoppable force. Wiley's just a guy with a wife and kids who's trying to do his best in a desperate situation. And I really wanted to show that these first responders that we all take for granted do this kind of thing selflessly. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't make the best money in the world. They work stupid hours. They get nothing but grief from the general public, and they still go out there and they do it.
Yeah. And I would go so far to say is that, you know, to the critics who are, you know, complaining about the fact that the Nordic elements don't work as much into the story is to say that in reality, from what I've read, every Nordic element does work its way into the story because there's more to Norse mythology and more to the Norse gods than Valhalla and, you know, in Ragnarok.
And I mean, getting drunk and, you know, fight.
Exactly.
There's more, more to it than that.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it than that.
Isn't he?
Jason, just stop. You're embarrassing yourself.
We're not talking Avengers here.
Sorry.
But thank you for indulging me on that discussion.
No problem.
Like I said, that I don't want to make it point out that this is not a major focus of the book, but I do like the way it was worked into the book. And it doesn't feel to me, from what I've read, that you've, you know, let anybody down in those categories, because it's just like any other quote you would put before a chapter. As far as I was concerned, as long as the quote had a little bit of something to do with the chapter, you're good in my book.
Now, the one thing I wanted to ask about, and I did mention it in my review, because of what other people had read, or written, I'm sorry, reviewed, the relationship between Wilder and Wiley. And like I said, obviously having never been in a combat situation of it. Yes, I know it's obvious, guys. Thank you. We don't have to focus on that.
And in all reality, Mike, I don't want you next to me in a combat situation.
Well, the thing about the relationship between Wiley and Spec 4 is they do grow close very quickly. They end up relying on each other. And one of the things that most people don't really realize about Spec 4 is by the end of Chapter 4, Spec 4 is alone. Her family's dead. All her National Guard friends are dead. Wiley's all she's got left. He's the only person she literally knows in the world, besides the other people in the group, and she feels very close to him. But at the same time, no matter what happens, Wiley won't break his vow to his wife. In fact, if anything, he finds that vow is more important now amongst the undead than it ever was before, because he wants to hold on to that piece of his life. He's close to Spec 4. They rely on each other for their lives, but it never grows beyond that.
Right. And see, and that's where I never questioned it, because and base it on your skill as a writer or, you know, whatever. It just seemed a natural thing. People thrown together in that sort of situation would naturally become close very quickly. And as you pointed out, he never I felt like he was tempted for like the briefest of seconds. But his focus, especially once he made contact with his wife, is like, yeah, you're a great person and I've got your back because you've got my back. But that's all it's ever going to be.
Yeah.
I think that's a fantastic aspect of the book as well, is because it's a common thing being discussed nowadays, especially. I mean, those who's worked in like what you mentioned, the first responder situation is that you, I mean, the gender is obvious. We recognize it, but it's not like, you know, it can't go beyond that. I mean, we know there are a partner. I mean, I don't know if Jason's ever been, you know, paired up with a female, you know, on the cop beat or anything, but I mean, you work hand in hand. And I say that it's a common thing that's being discussed right now because we have that situation going on with, you know, women being in combat areas and now, you know, the possibility of them doing specialized forces. And I've heard many a discussion about this, like that it'll never work because, you know, of the situation that they'll be in. And one of the things that they discuss is the sexual conflict. And so you've kind of taken on that subject.
Yeah, kind of from a, when you look at it that way, I didn't intend to set out that way, but I guess I kind of did jump in the middle of that with both feet.
I think more than anything, Jeff, you know, anybody that's not worked in law enforcement knows that, that's worked in law enforcement knows that, you know, you're, whether it's law enforcement or combat, is that, you know, your crew, your partner, everything, you rely so much on each other that you become so tight knit. That I'll use myself as an example. Me and
of course you will.
Yeah, I will. me and my partner Don, when I worked weekend nights for a while, we knew each other. Like I said, we were stuck in a car for minimum of 8 hours. Normally, we work 12-hour shifts, so. 12 hours, it was just the two of us. Could you imagine being in a 12-hour car ride twice a week, every week for a year, for 2 years straight? You talk about anything and everything. You learn each other's mannerisms so well. You understand, you know, everything that's going on in each other's lives. I mean, kid you not, Don probably knew more about my past in them 2 years than my current wife does. Just because that's what you have to do. And then on top of that, you have such faith in the other person that, you know, you become, at least me and him, we became such great friends out of it that, no, I was never paired up with a female officer. We only had a handful of them in our department. But, you know, I could imagine, I've seen myself, every one of our female officers when I was there, married their partner. And actually I've seen one where she divorced her husband and married a partner. And that's kind of the way that it happens. It's because you're so tight knit. You spend so much time together that you do get this very close bond. And I'm sure it's the same way in the military.
Yes.
I don't know. I think that's, I mean, I understand, you know, under certain circumstances, things will happen. And I guess what I'm referring to, to go a little bit further with what I've said. And again, Jason, I didn't mean to just to say that it had to do with a male-female relationship either. Because as you're talking, it's like anything about what you said could be taken in a, you know, a homosexual way. And so, and I'm not saying that existed, but we do know that bromance, the term exists for a reason. And you also know I love you. But anyway.
We are afterlife partners after all.
But in the meantime.
Well, I like the way that Jason mentioned his current wife.
Did so I say I'm current just wondering wife? If there's something
possibly, you know, are you possibly Freudian slipping something?
I mean, because I do have
her phone.
What I meant to say is we weren't married at the time. We didn't even know each other at the time. So I didn't mean like,
but anyway,
another part of what I
wanted to say about, you know, the way it was approached in the book is that it also approaches that standpoint of that just because the zombie apocalypse is happening. And this is something we've talked about many times before. It doesn't mean that all rules change. Certain moralities are still going to exist.
Human moralities.
Exactly.
And that's the main part of this that I think I like the most is that it's not just kind of jumping into the political ring, so to speak. And that's, I guess, what I like the most about writers, being one, because, you know, I spend a lot of time actually thinking really hard about what I'm writing sometimes to see, am I jumping into the middle of something? Because I'm also, you know, a literary person who have studied the crap for my whole life. So I know that there's hidden meanings in everything you write, whether you intended it or not.
Yeah. Layers of meaning.
Yeah. Whether you intended it or not. But I mean, you know, outside of that alone, you know, because it kind of does look like jumping into the ring, but quite simply, it is people maintaining a certain level of morality.
Exactly.
Something we've talked about with The Walking Dead constantly.
Yes. Speaking of, why don't we...
D.A. does that very well in this book with his, with the character Wiley, is, you know, there's a guy, one of the characters that, you know, I'm actually glad he's dead. but Wiley was like bound and determined because of his moral code, you know, because he's a decent guy, that he was going to go get him. And, you know, I just think that, you know, some writers would just go, you know, nope, because I know he's a bad character and nobody's going to like him. We're going to leave him, you know, twisting in the wind. And you didn't do that. I mean, like I said, I hated the character just from the brief description that you gave. And I'm glad that he was eviscerated and probably died in horrible pain. But the fact that Wiley was willing to make that sacrifice despite the danger that it brought to him and his crew, I think that's fantastic.
And on that note, I'm hopefully not cutting off a DA response in this one. But on that note, check this segue out. That's kind of what I was saying with the Laurie situation in The Walking Dead, where they pretty much had to make us like her before they could kill her off. And now we have this really strong affinity for Rick, because Rick is totally, you know, like freaked out about this Laurie situation, so that Jason can get into this Walking Dead talk since we haven't gotten to it yet.
Yes, thank you.
That was probably your least subtle segment.
Well, only because I announced it. If I hadn't announced it.
All right. This past week, The Walking Dead returned for the second half of season 3 with the highest ratings in the history of AMC, beating itself. Again. They had 12.3 million viewers, notching out its previous mark of 10.9 this past October. Just to put that in perspective, what's better is that more than half of them are in the 18 to 49 demographic, which is what they want for advertisement. And 7.7 in the key demo viewers is the highest in basic cable history ever. It even edged out broadcast hits like Modern Family, The Big Bang Theory, and NCIS.
Wow.
But did it kick Mad Men's ass?
Yes, because if it's the highest ratings ever. That, yes.
That would be the whole ever.
So that's AMC. So that's AMC kicked their own ass again.
Yes. So basically what we have is we have The Walking Dead in season 1 being the highest AMC show and the highest cable show viewed with, like, you know, 7 or 8 million. Then they did it again in season 2 with 9 million. Then they did it again in season 3 with 10 million. Now they trumped that by adding another 2.3 million. Well, not 2.3, 10.9 at the beginning, jumped it up another like over a million people with 12.3. I mean, that is, now you're getting into big numbers even for broadcast ratings.
Yeah.
So let's get into what about this episode then drew in this many people.
So let's talk about what we liked about The Suicide King. First of all, right from the beginning, I liked, you know, busting Daryl and Merle out of the pit. I mean, here you have at the end of the last season or end of the last episode, you had them, you know, getting Glenn and Maggie and getting them safely out and leaving Daryl behind. And you think that, you know, they would regroup, go back later on, you know, a day or two later or something when things have kind of calmed down. No, they did not give
back in.
Yeah, they went straight back in, not giving the governor and his crew any time to regroup before coming back. And Maggie just sniping people off. I love that.
It's because you're in love with Maggie.
But... I am in love with Maggie.
Yeah. Not a bad one to fall for.
No. No. Let's see. So that is definitely one of the things that I really like. This is a roundtable discussion, so I just want to let you guys know that. You guys can jump in at any time what you liked about this.
Is then Andrea dead yet? Because I want her dead.
Yeah, they didn't kill her off, unfortunately.
Well, in fact, she became stronger.
Well, I know. I saw it. I'm really wishing, just like I did in the first, the first part of this season, I really, really wanted Lori dead. And now that she's dead, I need someone else to die. So,
The only problem with Lori dying is that now she's become a serious problem for Rick. But
because Rick ends up going batshit crazy.
Yeah. I've wanted her dead since she shot Daryl.
Andrea, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
They told her not to shoot.
How dare you shoot Daryl?
She told her not to shoot. They were going to check it out, and she decides to shoot anyway, even though they're standing right there. One, she shot Daryl. And two, if that would have been me, if I'd have been Rick, I would have marched right back up there and shot her for shooting through us. You don't do that. She's not a sniper. She's not some ex-SEAL that can, hit a penny at 1,000 yards. She's this idiot with a scoped rifle who just put a bullet between six people to try to shoot what she thought was a walker. I'd have walked right back up there and shot her in the forehead.
Yeah, you don't risk your own people's lives like that.
Yeah. Well, she's had a serious, issue since her sister died, basically. I mean, hook it up with Shane just because he happened to be, crazy.
She catch the crazy from him or something?
That's what I'm thinking.
Well, I think she caught the crazy from the fact that she actually tried to die and Dale wouldn't let her. Let's not forget that she should have been written off if it wasn't for Dale. Now there's no Dale, so there's nobody to keep her crazy in check.
I have to say the highlight of this whole episode actually came from Rick knocking Merle out with the butt of his gun.
That was pretty good.
Like, I just loved it. Here's Merle going off, and then Rick's just like, that's it, I'm done with you. Slam. Mm-hmm. And then them talking, him and Daryl talking on the by the cars, and you can see in the background Merle waking up.
Groaning and getting to his feet, like, oh.
To me, it's like, it's one of them, what we've all would love to do to Merle, is just constantly, just everybody get in a line, and knock him out, and as soon as he wakes up, the next person steps up.
Like that scene from the Airplane movie where they just, start slapping, calm down. Next person comes up, calm down, smack.
Yes.
Next person's got a pipe.
The governor also definitely went crazy. Now, there is a lot of talk about...
I'm sorry, did you say went crazy?
Yeah, he was already crazy.
He was already, but he was hiding it very well. And now all of a sudden...
I don't think he actually went crazy, though. I mean, he's very calculated.
You've got to be pretty nuts to want to recreate the nightly news by putting zombie heads in aquariums.
Well, I had
for
my
this
own-
episode, this episode ended too soon because it was a case of where I don't think the governor was being crazy by turning his back on people. He was trying to create a new leader in the group through Andrea.
See, I didn't see it that way. What I saw is that the governor, who was always the person that people went to because he had the answers, all of a sudden he doesn't have the answers. And because he doesn't have the answers, he doesn't want to deal with anybody.
But he was still packing up and fully expecting that everybody was going to follow him to take revenge or whatever.
Well, but on top of that, the way that he led people before was to give them what they want. You got to remember, basically, the governor is, going right by the tyrant playbook.
Yeah, Andrea is a take the blinders off type of person. And they were in a situation where the blinders were off now for the townspeople. The townspeople were basically begging the governor to come lie to them some more. So instead of doing so... he let Andrea tell them the truth.
Right. And then you also have the scene where the people want to leave and you have the military, paramilitary, should I say.
That was pretty funny, actually.
You know, basically, you know, pointing guns, putting guns in their chest, telling them to stay and but ready to shoot their own people. Once again, what you're seeing is the de-evolution of a society going towards complete complete tyrannical government.
That's one of the things I touched on in my writing, is that a situation like that, you know, we'll use zombies as an example. It's going to bring out either the best or the worst in people, and depending on your nature. Like Hurricane Katrina, you had people that were risking their lives to save people that were trapped in houses. By the same token, you had idiots that were shooting at rescue choppers. It's going to run the gamut. You're either going to see people that are going to be heroic, that are going to go the extra mile to save people, and you're going to see the people that are only concerned about themselves.
Right, and so I think Woodbury is a great example of where. The governor is using, and he was even before this, but he was keeping up a good facade, making the people think that by keeping them safe, you know, he doesn't need to control them by force. That now all of a sudden he's gotten to a point where him and his paramilitary are the only way to keep the people at bay, should I say, his people, is to use force and to not hide the fact that he's using force on them.
And this is where I say that Andrea has actually become a major tool for him, because now he's turning the people into his force. He needs more than just his paramilitary.
Yeah.
In order to take the prison. He needs all of these people behind him. What's the best way to do that? You have the person that's going to speak the truth to them, go out and talk to them. That's why that's what was so important about that shot of him standing in the window watching.
You know,
is that he basically set this in motion.
This whole episode was kind of a might makes right kind of deal, because you also had the conversation with Therese and Sasha, and then the other two people that I can't remember off the top of my head.
The red shirts, yeah.
Yeah, where they were saying that, you know, you know, we basically have a woman and a kid. We can take them and take all of their stuff. And Therese and Sasha were the ones that, you know, basically said, no, they're good people. Let's not do it. And so, you know, with that, without the, you know, you have to remember so much of what we do is governed simply because of the fact that we don't do bad things because there's consequences to it. You take away the consequences and a lot of people will do what they can, not just to survive, but to try to thrive.
Because they can.
Because they can, because there's no one to stop them. And so if that means killing a 12-year-old kid and a woman and a, you know, baby, then, you know, they're going to do that because there's no one there to stop them. There's no recourse for it. And I think that's where, you know, you kind of talked where you mentioned, DA, that it brings out the best and worst in people. We saw that again, as you mentioned, in Hurricane Katrina, where people were at the Superdome and, you know, people were getting raped. Because there were so many people packed in there that there was no way of knowing who was doing what.
Exactly. It does have a way of reducing things to the lowest common denominator. You know, it's going to bring out the best and the worst in people, sometimes in the same people.
Right. And then, you know, the last thing that I want to talk about real quick is the Rick going, as I said, batshit crazy. And literally seeing Lori, or as I put it, the woman in white, which is a literary reference. See, I can do that too.
You just alliterated and you don't read. I'm confused.
Yeah. Is your wife there feeding you notes?
The current one, not the future.
The current one. Yeah,
the current wife.
Past one.
The future ex-Mrs.
Anyway. So, you know, that's the other thing is going to be not just the breakdown in society and what's going on with people, but the breakdown in your own self. Because, you know, when people are put in stressful situations, you get PTSD. I mean, and we see that coming with our military when they come back from war. You see that in law enforcement, firemen that have to do something, you know, they do something heroic. But the consequence of that is that it ends up messing them up mentally. Well, when you're in an apocalypse like this, not only are you messed up, but you have no escape from it.
Yeah.
And so it just keeps feeding and making it worse. And so Rick is a great example of somebody who is being looked up to as a leader. He's being asked to make these really hard decisions, such as, you know, who lives and who dies. And especially in the case of Tyrese and his gang, you know, if they stay, they live. If he sends them off, yeah, they might live, but he's essentially sending them off to their death. And this whole time, he's not even in the right state of mind. And he's been, you know, he's sleep deprived on top of that.
Yeah. Well, there's two things about this episode that bother me about this, especially when you get into this standpoint, is that I know that everybody's been talking about it as a dictatorship, but when did it really become a dictatorship to the point where everybody is really hinged on every word he has to say? Because everybody was so opinionated up to this point. And then now all Herschel does is try to give advice. And then the other problem I have with this episode is, why does it have to end like every, I mean, this is such a cliche ending. Is we have a misunderstanding that is going to cost lives.
Well, my complaint with The Walking Dead is I loved the comics, and I loved the first two seasons, but season three is rapidly turning into people arguing with some dead people in the background.
And it, you
know, I want to watch a soap opera. I could watch soap operas in the afternoon. You know, I want to see,
don't
see
do
more.
It.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't waste my time. But my point is, you know, if I wanted to watch, you know, As the World Turns, I could watch As the World Turns. I don't need to watch, you know, everybody's little nuances of the relationships. I don't care. That's not why I'm watching the show.
Right. I think with, you know, a lot of the draw this season and why they gained so many new viewers is because of that, though. A lot of people, you know, you're going to have the people like us that are into the survival, the zombie aspect, you know, that type of stuff. But then you're also going to have people such as my wife, my current one, that that watches it not because she's so much into what's going on with the zombies, but more with, you know, the relationship between the people, you know, as she puts it, you know, the relationship between Glenn and Maggie, the relationship between Rick and Lori was really one that, you know, she really got into.
I know to tell a good story, you've got to really delve in to what makes these characters who they are. But by the same token, that's what killed the TV show The Unit for me. I loved that show, but it got to the point where you were spending more time dealing with their wives bickering with one another than you were about missions. And I watched the show to watch the Delta operators, yeah. Not, you know, Army housewives.
To a certain extent, I have to be in agreement with DA because it's you know, we've talked about right from the beginning that we've constantly gotten on people's cases because they're always like, well, how come there's not enough zombie action? And we're like, well, zombie apocalypse is just as much about the survivors as it is about the zombies themselves.
Exactly.
But I think this episode though has turned into turning into a soap opera of sorts, especially when they have this type of an ending to an episode. I mean, this is one of those endings that when you watch TV shows, it's a cliche. It's just to hook you into the next episode and hopefully probably the next five, because it's going to drag it out forever. It's that one thing that always pops up that we're just like, no, it's a misunderstanding. And they're going to drag it out forever. You know, they're going to drag it out probably for the rest of the season. And the one thing I loved about this show is that misunderstandings did not drag out episodes. Now this is probably going to go on for the rest of the season about what's going to happen to Tyrese and that, you know, what's going to happen to Tyrese and his sister and the rest of the group. How are they going to respond to it? Tyrese is probably going to decide he has to be a badass and fight back and all this other stuff. And you're just sitting there going, it's a misunderstanding.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's it. That's what I got. Like I say, you know, the whole woman in white thing, I didn't like the fact that they put her in white. To me, that seemed
cliche.
That was also cliche, you know. But, she's a ghost. She's wearing white. Ooh.
But to use your so apt description, you know, making Rick go batshit crazy isn't necessarily conducive to a good story. I'm already getting tired of the Rick crazy aspect. You know, in the comics, they drug that out forever. And to be honest, it's why I quit reading them. He carried that unconnected phone around for 12 issues talking to Lori on the phone. Wow. Well, yeah, you can play the guy. The guy's stressed out. The guy's got, you know, he's most likely got PTSD. Yeah, it makes him human. But don't make it the focus of the show. Come on.
Right. And so I as we're recording this right now, this week's season or episode has already aired. We'll be able to watch it afterwards. If you thanks to DVR and download.
And I of course want to throw this out there. You might have been going in this direction, but I want to just throw out there that for those of you Walking Dead Week in Review fans who are catching us on the Creepercast, still talking about The Walking Dead as we promised, because we just can't stop. And and especially to our co-host who used to work with us on the show, because I'm sure she has a lot of schooling to do. Based on everything we've said, we would love to hear from you all. Please contact us at feedback@creepercast.com. Click that leave me a message link on the creepercast.com website.
Or give us a call at 503-454-6941. And I think that's enough Walking Dead talk. So for almost the past year, we've been talking about this Creepercast iTunes sweepstakes, where you leave us a comment and a review on our iTunes page. And we finally ended this as of midnight last night, which was February 16th or February 17th, I guess, at midnight. But either way,
it's 16th at midnight, so it's the 17th right now.
Yes.
Based on our recording date.
And with that, I did put all of the reviews into a proverbial hat, i.e. random.org. And drew a winner for each one. And I'm going to announce that now, and we'll put the names up on our website.
I hope it was me. Oh, wait, I can't win. Damn it.
We want you guys to, the winners of these, to email me at... feedback@creepercast.com to let us know what you choose out of our Creepercast swag store and what you what your address is, so that I can have it shipped to your house. And remember, to choose that, you go to creepercast.com/swag. So on to this, no drum roll or anything. I'm going to head right over to our Creepercast drawing. And we had 8 people that left stuff for us, and the number one person was Fatal Shot 1981. So if you're Fatal Shot 1981, simply send me an email with what your choice is out of the Creepercast swag store. And for the Walking Dead Week in Review, it would be the person that gave us an incredibly low rating, Bite Right. BYTEWRITE. So go ahead, Bite Right, choose what you want, send us an email, and
that's one item out one of creepercast.com/swagstore.
And we will send you that.
If I won, yes. I'd pick the Creepercast Full Moon Fever Flask. That thing is cool.
Yeah. See, that's what I've been saying the whole time. I should get that just because
you're you.
I'm that cool.
those flasks are awesome.
Yeah, Jeff came up with that logo. That's pretty good. I like that.
Actually, that logo was created by Nessa, but yeah, I helped throw it together onto the flask, so I guess I'll take some credit.
I like all 3 of the flasks. Those are just awesome, guys.
And I'm excited.
Any kind of flask is awesome because it holds
absolutely
good stuff in it.
After this episode, we go on a little bit of hiatus while we reformat the website and the logo and everything. So we've got a new kick-ass logo that'll be coming back when the Creepercast returns.
Indeed.
Sweet.
All right.
In the meantime, though, before we wrap this up, because I don't know if that's the direction you're going.
No,
with it.
That isn't. I figure, you know what?
Okay.
We've still got about another 15 minutes. We might as well spread this out to a full 2 hours.
Okay, I don't know what you had in mind, but what I have in mind is I'm really curious about these 5 stages of zombism. I know that, you know what, you and I have talked about it a lot, and we usually come up with 3 or 4, but DA has 5, and I need to hear more.
Well, the 5 stages, basically, first one I call a grabber. It's a zombie that, for whatever reason, is trapped. Maybe it turned while seatbelt in the car, or it's trapped between 2 cars. It can't move. All it can do is grab you as you walk by. Second type's a crawler. Pretty much obvious there. It's a zombie that, for whatever reason, doesn't have any use of its legs. It can only crawl after you. Those are especially dangerous if you're walking past a car.
Herschel can attest to that.
Yeah, Herschel can definitely attest. Well, his mistake was stepping over one. I would have cracked it in the head as I went by. But third type is a shambler. Those are your basic George Romero, dragon one foot, slow, plodding zombie. What most people think of when they think of zombies, that's your basic shambler. Then I've got a sprinter, and those are inspired because of the movie, the remake of the Dawn of the Dead, where the zombies were fast. I wanted to add that element because, to me, the fast zombies really ratchet up the tension. And a zombie that turns from a bite in the arm, why suddenly does its legs not work?
That's a good one.
If it turns and the legs are intact, there's no reason why it can't be fast. And it's not going to get tired. But the last one I came up with, I call shriekers. And they're the ones that will, when they see you, let out a loud enough moan that it attracts other zombies. And Wiley makes it a priority to take out the shriekers first.
That's awesome. I like that. I think we're... ones that you really had that we didn't think of was the grabber, because we never really thought about, you know, ones that can't move. You know, we kind of came from the standpoint that of the hierarchy is you have the ones that have a slight intelligence left to them, the freshest ones. And they're the ones that can run. They would be like, as you put it, your shriekers. And then you have the ones that basically are fast, but they're non-thinking. They don't have any type of strategy. They can't climb, they can't do anything. And then you have the ones that just walk around, your ramblers.
And ours was kind of based on the idea of if there was still intelligence, you know, embedded in them. So ours kind of had that to go with it. And along with it, you know, with the way you put the sprinter thing is that if they were just bit and then became one, then obviously they wouldn't be stupid right away. So that there would be a certain amount of intelligence that might stay intact.
Yeah, and that's how we kind of created intelligence.
Yeah. That's how we kind of created our hierarchy, is based on a possibility of intelligence still existing. I like the way, you know, where you went with it, which is, you know, the type of, especially the grabber and the crawler, that was one that we hadn't even considered.
No. The other thing that we kind of went with ours was I talked to a person that is a mortician and actually has was a MD at one time. I can't remember if he's a mortician or no, he works in the MA's office. So he investigates dead bodies, not involves them.
Quincy.
Yeah. There we go.
And basically what he said is he was talking about how if there was really a zombie outbreak, the survival of a dead body would actually only last, about 3 to 4 weeks because of different factors such as slick skin and other things happening. But then you also have where without the heart pumping blood would actually pool all to their legs. So eventually their legs would be so full of blood and so heavy that they wouldn't be able to move them. And that's why they would end up getting slower and slower as time goes on. Even if they don't need nourishment to stay alive, after about 3 weeks of a person being bit, they would go from being able to go running to slowing down to basically being more of a stationary object.
Kind of a Maslow's hierarchy of the zombie.
Yeah.
So that was kind of where we went, where me and Jeff came up with that hierarchy is.
Well, and I was going partially too on the, on zombie autopsies, the Stephen. Oh, why can't I remember his last name right now? But because I've been working really hard to get him on the show, but the zombie autopsies book, I don't know if you've seen it, DA, but it's basically, you know, he is a brain doctor, the guy who wrote it. And he was kind of going from that aspect that, zombism is a slow moving process. So even though the hunger can exist within a short, you know, within a short amount of time, the full zombism takes a while.
Yeah.
So, and that's where kind of where we were going with that's why I said the intelligent or the Maslow's even aspect of it is that it's a slow process. So you can start as a higher thinking zombie and then become nothing but a shambler.
Yeah. I can see how that would work.
So, I definitely like the idea, because we never thought about, take The Walking Dead. You have, you know, the walker that's
the
in the
walkers, the biters, the
yeah. But I mean, you have the one that's stuck in the well, you know. You have, but you never think about ones that, you know, like you said, if they're stuck in a car seat, would they have the intelligence to unhook themselves?
I wouldn't think so. that's a little more than fine motor skill. I think if you buckled a chimp into a car, I'm not sure it would be able to get out.
Well, I know my 1.5-year-old son can't figure out how to get out. So if my kids
figured it out pretty quick.
But I mean, so even if they just regress down to that level, to a 1-year-old, they wouldn't be able to figure that out.
Well, even a 1-year-old has problem solving intelligence, which yeah. I don't think you're going to see in the average zombie. If it's beyond, pushing on a door, and if it doesn't open, they start beating on the door. I've never really seen the zombies as having anything approaching higher order intelligence.
In our defense, the reason why we created that is because we were looking at a lot of zombie films that were kind of outside the norm. On the same token, I look at films as in like Warm Bodies and say that's not possible.
Yeah. I don't even care to see that movie.
Yeah, well, I've been told that I will see it because I understand that there's probably a humorous aspect to it. Especially, I mean, you'll have people involved in it that are definitely funny, and the trailer looks like it's funny. But to come out of it thinking that, I think that what worries me about that film is that people are going to come out of it thinking that, oh, the world of zombies has been changed forever. And it's like, no, it hasn't, because it's pretty obvious. If you're dead, you're dead.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no
coming back from that.
Yeah, you can't come back from that.
Unless you're in Marvel Comics.
Yeah, if love could bring you back from being dead, there are many dead people who wouldn't be dead anymore. It's quite obvious to figure that out. So even suspension of disbelief on that one is next to impossible.
Right.
Yeah, and I'll probably watch it because you'll make me watch it.
Owen goes, you should read the book. No.
I actually tried reading the book and I didn't care for it.
So to kind of finish this up, rather than just talking about, the hierarchy of zombies, I want to jump into the last thing that I wanted to talk about, which is bug out bags. Now,
of course,
not many
really. We can't talk about DA's upcoming book. We can't talk about this.
Well, actually, we will end with DA's.
Yeah,
I think the bug out bag is actually a good one because I was reading the Franklin Wolf stuff, and a lot of what Jason said is in there, and there's even a few things that aren't. So go ahead, Jason.
So yeah, bug out bag, the reason that I think everybody should have a bug out bag, whether it's zombie or anything else, is that you basically have two choices. And if you listen to my zombie survival guides that I put out on The Walking Dead Week in Review, I've covered some of this, but your two choices in anything as far as an apocalypse or anything like that is, either stay put where you're at or get the hell out of Dodge. And when you have to get the hell out of Dodge, that is not the time to be looking around your house hoping that you have what you need to leave. So having a bag that is set to go, that is ready basically at a moment's notice to pick up and carry and has what you need to survive is important for anybody at any time. And some of the stuff that I think, as far as the bag goes, you can make it out of just about anything. You can make it out of a duffel bag. You can do whatever you want. I know a lot of people like the military style backpacks. Me, I'm more of a fan of, just a simple internal backpacker's backpack. And you guys can jump in at any time. With that, some of the things that I would put in there, would be an extra set of footwear. So, you're probably going to be running out with your, tennis shoes. Have a pair of hiking boots. Hiking boots are going to mean a lot when it comes to durability and protection.
Yeah, I definitely want a good pair of tactical boots. Fortunately, I've got about 6 pair in my closet.
See, and I always just wear my duty boots. So
yeah,
I wear that even now with my job as a media consultant. To me, they're nice. I can shine them up, and they can go through any terrain.
Mm-hmm. And they're comfortable.
And it's very comfortable. And then of course with that, as far as clothing, you're gonna want some good moisture wicking socks. Maybe some wool socks, wool hat. Think about the weather that you tend to have. what I wear up here in Michigan is probably going to be different than what you guys are going to wear down south.
Like where I am?
Like where you're at. So, you know, think about, you know, the clothing, because, you know, if you go by the rule of threes, and I always hated the rule of threes because that's too general for me. I like to go to the extreme and call it the rule of fives. You know, they say you can't go more than 3 minutes without oxygen. Well, that's been proven false because people have survived up to 5 minutes without brain damage, without oxygen.
That's true, but that's the exception, not the rule.
Right. That's why I say I like to take it to the extreme. 3 days without water. Again, that depends on your climate. If you're in a very dry climate, dry, hot climate, it's going to be less than 3 days. If you're not moving around at all and you're in a temperate climate, you can probably go up to 5 days without water. And food, you know, 3 weeks without food. Again, it depends how much energy you're burning and how much calories you're burning each day. In fact, I know one person that gave up food completely for Lent. So we'll see how he lasts for 40 days. I'm kind of interested to see what's going to happen, but, so I like
something
to take,
tells me that that's not realistic.
Yeah, I'm thinking so too. He says he did it last year. I don't know where this came from, but somebody, I also heard 3 hours without shelter. And shelter includes clothes. So, you know, you need good shelter. You need good clothes. Shelter, you know, a lot of people say make sure that you have shelter. Make sure you have a hammock and you have 100 feet of paracord and stuff like that. I think that's good stuff to have in there. But I think when it comes to especially a zombie apocalypse, shelter will probably be the one thing that you could probably find fairly easily. Probably. Safe shelter is going to be a little more difficult, but shelter in and of itself.
I'm headed to, excuse me. I'm headed to DA's place, honestly. So
if you can find it.
The one thing I don't like, that when people talk about, you know, their bug out bag or getting out of Dodge is the vehicle. A lot of people think, you know, get yourself an armored truck, which seems like a good idea up front, but as I've stated before, basically all you're doing is you're creating yourself a tomb.
I think one of the better vehicles to use for a bug out, especially if you're bugging out light, are bicycles. When you've got roads that are just snarled with traffic for miles, you're not going to stop a bike.
No, and a bike can, you know, at full tilt can get up to 30 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So yeah, the average person can pedal up to 30 miles an hour. That's faster than a human can run, let alone a walker. And you can, and they're quiet. I think a bike is a good one. I think as far as just a vehicle, get yourself a normal SUV.
Yeah.
Besides being all terrain, if it has, most SUVs have 4-wheel drive, you have a lot of exits. So, you know,
so you're not abdicating the Toyotas or the Hyundais that The Walking Dead has been backing.
No. The thing with their vehicles is they're not 4-wheel drive. You need 4-wheel drive because roads are going to be blocked and you're going to have to drive around stuff in the road. Water is going to be incredibly important. So make sure that not only do you have a way of sanitizing water, i.e. that means a way of filtering it directly, a way of purifying it, making it biologically safe with tablets or even chlorine. Chlorine is a great one. And you can find chlorine just about anywhere.
Oh, that's the old adage, when in doubt, boil it out.
That, exactly. It takes the longest, but it works.
It's guaranteed to work.
And even then, you know, some people say boil it for only 1 minute after it hits the boiling point. I've also heard 15 minutes. The way I look at it is, you know, if it hits the boiling point, boil it just for, you know, a couple minutes. You don't have to wait a long time once it starts boiling. 160 degrees is what kills just about everything. So at the boiling point, it's 212. But then also have a way of carrying water. You know, that's the big thing, is that you can't stay with water all the time. You need a way to transport it. And so that means jugs and not just small little canteens. I mean, that's where having a good vehicle with enough room to carry jugs of water is going to be important. You know, factor in a half a gallon of drinking water a day. Minimum. Food is one that initially isn't going to be a problem, especially as you hit what's known as a tilting point, and that's where the zombies outnumber people. But over time, it's going to be harder and harder to come by because, you know, food goes bad. So think about that as you're stocking up. Let's see, what else? You know, and that also means hunting and fishing equipment. We covered that. Learn how to snare. Learn how to fish. Learn how to set up fish traps. If you come across a stream, you're much more, your chances of getting a fish are a lot better by putting what's known as a fish cage in than by dropping a line in and hoping you something bites. Some of the tools, you know, a hatchet, machete, you know, think multi-purpose with everything in your bug out bag.
Elegant.
everything, you know, when remember, DA, you probably remember how does this go? Ounces equal pound. No. I can't even remember how it goes. Something equals ounces, ounces equal pounds.
Grams equals ounces.
Yeah, that's it. Grams equals ounces, ounces equal pounds. So even though something looks light and you can just stick it in there, you know, everything, you can't, all of that adds up. And anybody that's tried hiking with even a 60-pound bag on their back knows that it gets tiring quickly. That's why the military has them running with it in basic training.
Exactly.
To get them used to it.
Build up your endurance.
And then also ahead of time, hike around with your bag so that you know how it feels. Let's see. Oh, maps. Remember, GPSs will still be around for a short amount of time, but eventually all of that goes. Having good maps, road maps, and if you can, topo maps.
Absolutely. Topo maps are worth their weight in gold.
Yes. And when I say road maps, you know, yeah, it's good to have a state road map of the major highways, but if you can get one of them state atlases that have the county maps in it, oh man, learning, you know, all of the ways around stuff and being able to have that will be invaluable. And then same thing with the topo maps, being able to hike and understand the terrain that you're going to be going up across. Let's see, bug repellent. I don't know why I for some reason, I just have this feeling that I'm going to end up getting eaten alive by bugs.
Eat a lot of garlic.
Does garlic repel bugs?
Yes.
Mosquitoes?
Yep.
I didn't know that.
If you eat fresh garlic, once it gets into your bloodstream, they won't touch you.
I know what I'm going to be eating a lot this summer then.
That, and it keeps sparkly vampires at bay.
Which is the most important part.
Absolutely.
And sunscreen. Trust me, you don't want to be getting a sunburn. But that just goes under basic first aid supplies. Yeah. You know, get as many first aid supplies as you can ahead of time. Everything from cortisone cream for poison ivy, Benadryl for allergic reactions, Imodium, because you're probably going to end up with a little bit of diarrhea. And then also, you know, hit up as many drug stores as you can. Learn about antibiotics, learn about stuff. And drug stores and pharmacies are going to be the first things to go out of stock when people start raiding them. So look for alternatives, such as smaller doctor's offices and even veterinary clinics. Because don't forget, the same antibiotics that work for us work for animals.
There are a number of natural plants that have antibiotic properties as well. Yeah. A little bit of research can teach you quite a bit about those.
Google now.
Yeah.
and then the last thing, I know one person says, you know, put gold and silver coins in your bag to trade with. To me, anything with monetary value that we have now will have no monetary value.
Pretty much. Bullets are going to be the currency.
Bullets and, in my opinion, cigarettes and alcohol.
Again, water and food.
Yep. Think. One thing to think about is, and I've said this, and it's kind of strange, you know, saying this with DA on, but think prison. What is valuable in prison?
Food.
is going to be valuable in an apocalypse. You know, and that even comes down to, you can read my or listen to my zombie survival guide, where I don't go into the details on how to make it, but I talk about that there are resources out there on how to make prune juice and how to distill that into a very small amount, but an amount of
and without giving away too much information, there are links to details.
There are, yes,
on the website.
on how to make your own moonshine out of prune juice. Pruno.
Out of just about anything. Well, Pruno is different than moonshine, but it's the same concept.
Well, yeah, but you distill the Pruno
right
into moonshine. So alcohol is also going to be something. So even if that means, you know, putting a flask of alcohol in, hey, you know what? That could mean food one day. Trading with somebody.
As part of trade, yeah.
Not to mention the antiseptic qualities of alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah, you get something with a good amount of alcohol in there, and you know, you can use that. You can also use it, some of it, to light a fire if you need to.
Exactly. Alcohol has a number of uses. Also, in some circumstances, you can use it as a fuel.
Yes, and I actually talked about that, how making your own ethyl alcohol, you know, you can rig up a regular gas generator to run on ethyl that you make yourself. And I also say don't throw out that methyl alcohol, the stuff that makes you go blind, because if you end up having somebody, you know, break in or try to steal your alcohol from you, you just give them that as a good gesture.
As a peacekeeping.
See what happens.
Nothing but the finest in beverages that make you go blind.
So anything you guys want to add to what I said? I just kind of grazed over some of the stuff.
No, I think that was great, and it's actually an almost perfect ending to this show. There's only one thing that can make the ending of this show better.
Well, I think, DA, can you tell us a little bit about upcoming projects?
Yeah, my second book is due out probably next month. I haven't got a confirmed release date from my publisher, Pendrag Publishing. Book two of the Ragnarok Rising saga is called Ragnarok Rising: The Reckoning. It picks up right where book one leaves off. I'm pretty excited about it. I learned a lot of lessons with Ragnarok Rising: The Awakening that I applied to book two, and I think book two is a much better book for it. I loved writing the first one, but I think the lessons I learned with that helped make book two stronger. I'm hoping that it'll have a release date sometime between now and April 1st, and as soon as I have a confirmed release date, I'll certainly be posting it. You can find out updates. I keep my website updated fairly regularly on any of my Facebook pages or my website, which is ragnarokrising.weebly.com. And I'd definitely love to answer anybody's questions. They can contact me through the website or through my Facebook pages. If anybody's got any questions about my writing, I'd be more than glad to answer them.
Awesome.
Psst. If you send us a copy, I'll review it.
I was already planning on it, Mike.
Yeah, that was actually, I was just about ready to make that announcement that he DA told me earlier today that he will make sure you get one of the preview copies. So, and on top of that, I just want to, you know, I'll comment real quickly about the lessons learned from the first book, because I know one of the ones you mentioned was that, you know, you don't have to build the world as, you know, that you created as hard anymore, because presumably before anybody reads the second one, they're going to read the first one. And I think that's, you know, that should be considered a common, you know, a common thing, is that you've created a very strong and dominant, you know, world for people, so that when they get into book two, I'm looking forward to hearing that they're just basically going to be thrown in this world now, because we know all about it before we even get to book two.
The back cover blurb that's going to be on the new book is already up on my website.
Awesome.
Well, then one other thing I want to mention, and unfortunately we got scooped on this when I heard DA's first interview, is not only do we have the second and eventually third book in the Ragnarok Rising series, but you mentioned a werewolf novel.
Yeah, it's something I've been working on as kind of a side project. It's tentatively titled Apex Predator. Basically, a werewolf would be at the absolute pinnacle of its food of the food chain. Nothing's going to eat it. It's going to eat pretty much anything it feels like. And it's a side project I've been working on here off and on. I hope to have Apex Predator probably before the end of the year. But my primary focus right now has been Book 3, which I've called tentatively titled Ragnarok Rising: The Crossing. Pendrig's definitely interested in The Crossing, but I don't know if I'm going to self-pub or continue with Pendrig with Apex Predator. I haven't decided yet.
Well, definitely keep us posted, and I'm definitely looking forward to reading it all of it.
Apex Predator is going to be your more traditional werewolf. Werewolves are not my cuddly boyfriend werewolf story. that's going to establish pretty much right off the bat. Yeah, nobody's gonna want to date this one.
Well, that's awesome because you know that's next. Honestly, I mean, you know, between the sparkly vampires and the loving the zombies back to life, now it's gonna be you know we've actually
pushed the werewolf line. I mean, because of the reinvention of Teen Wolf
of Twilight. Well, Twilight also
pushed the werewolves into that line.
Yeah. Now, see, and I hate to admit this. You know, especially since this means everyone's going to hear.
He likes it when Jacob takes his shirt off.
Oh, sure.
Everybody knows. Now everybody knows.
I have actually read all four of those god-awful books, and they are not. And spoiler alert, in case you're, you know, a tween listening to this podcast, they're not werewolves. And it's actually brought out, and I believe it's book four. They're shapeshifters who end up having to they take the shape of wolves, but they are not werewolves. So, just laying that out there.
Now, my first question is these god awful books you've read all four. Why didn't you stop at the first one?
Like I did.
Okay.
Or half the first one like I did.
And I have made this defense before. The reason I kept reading was I thought, honest to God, it had to get better.
You were wrong.
I was wrong. And by the time book four came out, it was out of sheer morbid curiosity to see what...
And that is the reason why we watch some of the movies we watch.
In there.
All right. I think with that, let's hit the music. All right, that was our podcast for this week. Survival 101 lesson, I don't know, whatever.
Survival 101. No, it was the D.A. Roberts Show.
The D.A. Roberts Show. D.A., I want to thank you for joining us, man. It was great having you on.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And I just really want to quickly, before you get to the contact info and all that other wonderful stuff, is remind everybody that, like Jason said it, you know, somewhere around the middle of the show, we do plan on taking a short vacation in order to rebrand, recreate, make everything look so much cooler and better. And when we come back, we will be coming back with The Devil Within, a couple of cast members, hopefully Bill O'Bush Jr. I haven't had a chance to contact him yet, but we will definitely be coming back with Elizabeth DiPrenzio and writer Matt... don't remember his last name, but writer Matt, and we will be talking to them.
Matthew Dean.
Jeez. Anyway, we will be talking to them about The Devil Within, and if you haven't heard what we think about The Devil Within, you could do so by listening to our monthly independent feature review. And then shortly thereafter, as DA has pretty much promised would happen, even though he doesn't know he did it, except that he did it to me personally, is that we will hopefully have him back to talk about the second book.
Be glad to be back on anytime, guys.
Yes. All right. Which would be great. In the meantime, while we are off, what can people do, Jason, in order to keep up with what's going on with the Creepercast?
Well, they can head on over to creepercast.com. They can also join us on Facebook at facebook.com/creepercast. They can hear all our updates by following us at creepercast or at twitter.com/creepercast and on Google Plus at creepercast.com/G+. And don't forget to get a hold of us during our time off. We love hearing from you guys. You know, keep us real during our hiatus by giving us a call at 503-454-6941, sending us an email at feedback@creepercast.com, or just leave us a message on the little pop-up that comes up on the left-hand side of the website. All right. Thank you guys for this week. DA, it was great again. Hope to have you back.
Be glad to be back anytime, guys.
Thank you for listening to my uncle's podcast.